You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
All right, friends, solo episode today. And by solo episode, I mean a classic solo episode. No Jimmy or Lisa today. Jimmy will be back with me next week as we continue that four-part series on the four dynamics that infect every relationship. But today, just me. We'll light the candle, of course, but what I'll be doing is giving some book reviews, some kind of annotated bibliography, I guess, on some systems theory materials for those of you that want to dig deeper. We just don't really do book reviews on this podcast very much. In fact, I don't know that I've ever done them, but I get asked about this all the time. So I thought, well, this would be helpful just to give you, in order of release, way back in the 60s up until today, some books that I've read that I've found helpful, some pluses and minuses. So, man, I think I'm covering like 8 or 10 books. So we're going to move quickly just to give you a taste. And obviously, just pick the ones that sound appealing to you. But probably the most common question I get when I speak and do my workshops is, what should I read? And it's always entertaining when somebody maybe doesn't know that I wrote a book on it, and then it's very awkward because I'm not inclined to recommend my own book. You know, when you're in school and you ran for some office and then you voted for yourself, I don't know how I feel about that. So in case you didn't know, if you thought, hey, all this guy does is have a podcast. No, I wrote a book about it conveniently called Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs. It's a systems theory book. It's also a faith book. You can find it, but I'm not going to talk about it today. I'm going to talk about the books that influence me, the authors, the thinkers, and the pluses and minuses. But before we do, just light this candle in faith that God is good. This is a very Australian bergamot and Banksia candle. Man, just going to take a smell. Banksia is a smell of home. You know, smell and memory are so profoundly attached, isn't it? Okay, so I'm just lighting this candle by faith that God is good and God is with us. And at least my proclivity is to forget the Lord. I tend to go it on my own. And so just to pause now, just take a breath and just remember the Lord and relax into the presence of God. Okay, so we have a number of thinkers that I'm going to cover today. And before we do, let me just quickly give us the three kind of things that systems theory offers us. The first one is, and I'll go quick because a lot of this is a rerun, but just to frame our conversation today. Systems theory helps you notice reactivity. Systems theory calls it anxiety, but that trips a lot of people up because there's a lot of people that don't see themselves as anxious. By the way, if you don't tend to see yourself as anxious, sometimes it's because you're generating the anxiety and you're not carrying it. The people around you are carrying it, so therefore you never feel it. I find it more helpful to talk about reactivity. Reactivity is an expression of anxiety. It's almost like a evidence or a symptom. And it's based on a certain kind of anxiety clinically called chronic anxiety, which is always generated by false needs. Anytime you and I don't get what we think we need in the moment, we get reactive. So if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those are real needs. Safety, security, and so on. But boy, humans have all of these false needs, dozens and dozens of them. The need to be respected, the need for people to treat each other courteously, the need to do it perfectly, the need to be liked, the need to be in control. These might be broad needs, but then you can get really specific as I've done on this show. Like the way I need my critics to understand me, the way I need my sermons to be amazing, this kind of crazy stuff, false needs. And when we don't get our false needs, we get filled with reactivity. If you tune in a couple of episodes ago, you'll listen to Jimmy and I spending a whole episode on reactivity. What is it? What does it look like? You can go listen to that. But the key on this first thing in systems theory, noticing reactivity, is how contagious it is. So one of the things you're noticing is the spread of anxiety or the spread of reactivity. And of course, I famously or infamously learned this in the emergency rooms and in the intensive care wards of a trauma hospital, where reactivity was just constantly flying around from families in crisis to overworked and exhausted and reactive staff to frightened young chaplains. So system theory number one teaches you to notice reactivity. Number two, and boy, this is where things get difficult and powerful. It forces you, or maybe a polite way to say it is system theory invites you to look at your own complicity in a situation before noticing the problem in another person. Boy, this was groundbreaking for me and still is. I am still prone to prefer to see the problem in someone else. When I'm traveling and doing my workshops, it's not long into my workshop, maybe half an hour or an hour, where somebody will say some form of, "Man, I wish Jim was here," because they're thinking of someone that really needs to hear these tools. I give people tools on how to notice and name and diffuse anxiety. And it's fun and, you know, people have some breakthroughs. So they're often saying, "Man, if only Jim was here." I get that. But system theory forces us or invites us to look at our own complicity. And it's really shocking. This is where change can really take place. It's really shocking when I notice, rather than what somebody is doing and how much that bothers me, to notice what I'm doing toward them. Or sometimes, like somebody like myself who is prone to enmeshment or over-functioning, then the classic situation for me is the way I am keeping the problem going by my contribution. So number one is noticing reactivity. Number two is noticing my own complicity rather than focusing on others. And then there's a piece of system theory that I personally think gets lost. And it's the third thing I want to point out, and then we'll get to the books. Systems is really interested in noticing earnestness and playfulness. So sometimes when I go into an organization, you know, I'm asked to kind of measure the amount of anxiety in the system or in the team, in the culture. And man, how do you do that? Like, that's a tricky thing. Well, there's several tools I have, but one of the simplest ones is I'm looking for the earnestness, the level of offense that's taking place, and the playfulness. Because system theorists know that playfulness opens up our heart and soul to change, and earnestness can typically keep us stuck. And as a pastor, some of the work I do is I pay attention to earnestness in the church, because you can imagine when we're talking about the sovereign King of the universe, Jesus Christ, when we're talking about matters of heaven and hell, salvation, chronic grinding poverty, boy, we can be tempted to fall into earnestness, can't we? Because it's very serious. The work we do is serious. Oftentimes system theorists are trying to dislodge the earnestness and bring in some playfulness to help have some breakthroughs. All right, hey, let's get to some books. So if we're going to begin at the beginning, I thought it would be fun to do these kind of in the order these books were released. So we're starting in the 1960s with the man himself, the dude of all dudes, Dr. Murray Bowen. Systems theory is also known as Bowen theory. Pretty cool when a theory is named after your last name. I doubt, for a number of reasons, that there's ever going to be a cuss theory. Mostly because who wants a cuss theory, right? Anyway, Murray Bowen, psychiatrist, working in a lockdown in a hospital in the 1950s, focusing on teenage onset, paranoid schizophrenic young men, has a breakthrough when he notices their interaction specifically with their mums on family visitation day, and thus systems theory was born. So Murray Bowen, you know what's funny is he, as much as he's an absolute legend, he's really only known for one book, Family Therapy in Clinical Practice. That's where it all began. But really, Bowen's work really began in the university classroom. He started teaching people enrolled in his classes. That's how his theory spread. And he gave lectures. You can find him on YouTube, for example. But his book, Family Therapy and Clinical Practice, would I recommend it? I don't know. On the one hand, yes, because it's where it all began. On the other hand, the cheapest you can find the book is $76 just for the Kindle. Crazy, right? You might be able to track down a used one. I've never seen it under $40. But that's my hesitation with it. Plus, I think you can get to Bowen by just Googling his name. There's so much that articles he wrote, and there's so much on YouTube. I don't know that I would recommend that book, but that's where it started. Okay, now, one of the very first systems theory books I bought and read was called The Family Crucible by Gus Napier and Carl Whitaker. The Family Crucible. Carl Whitaker was a legend in early family systems practice. He was a therapist. And this book is fun. I mean, look, it's dated. You're going to read it and cringe a little bit, but it really picks out the playfulness of systems theory. Carl Whitaker, in the book The Family Crucible, famously wrestles a teenage young man in front of his dad because the teenager gave his dad some lip, some disrespect, and the dad didn't correct him. So Whitaker leaps out of his chair as the therapist and tackles this teenage boy playfully, but also seriously. All right, Family Crucible. I like this book because Gus Napier, he's the intern. He's following and learning from Carl Whitaker, and he gets to be in the room over a series of months of therapy with this one family. So the two reasons this book is interesting is it's just, frankly, fun and fascinating to get to be in the room where it happens, right? Yeah, thanks, Hamilton. Get to be in the room, and Napier puts us in the therapy room week by week by week. So one chapter is like a verbatim of the conversation between Carl Whitaker and the family. And then the next chapter is Napier analyzing what happened and what systems practices they used. Great book, The Family Crucible. The one key idea that it really brings to the fore, that's a big systems idea, is the idea of the identified patient. The identified patient. Yeah, by the way, you don't have to read these books because I'm going to pull out a little lesson from each of them on what's helpful. So in this book, it was the identified patient that lit me up. If I remember, I've not read this book since the 90s, but if I remember right, the family brought a teenager in. I think it was their teenage daughter because she was exhibiting signs of depression and problems. But she, in systems theory, is not the problem. The family relationships is what the problem is. And Whitaker and Napier are looking at not just this young lady, but the way the family treat each other. Where things get fascinating is often they won't even talk to the teenager. They're only going to focus, for example, on the marriage between mom and dad. The simple idea being if the marriage is not well, then one of the kids might show signs or symptoms of a sick marriage. This is where family systems get so fascinating, is you would think that the way to work on a marriage is to notice the husband and wife, but Napier and Whitaker would look at the behavior of the kids to look for the symptoms of the marriage. That would be an example. So in this case, this young lady, this teenage girl, is what's called the identified patient. Sometimes in some circles, it's called the scapegoat. So anytime you're in a system, a group of people who relate over time, a team or a staff or a family, you can look for the identified patient. Who is the person that everybody is pointing to as the problem? Okay, interesting. Maybe that person is the problem. Maybe, however, they are simply the identified patient of a sick system. Okay, so Napier and Whitaker, Family Crucible. Let's move on. All right, we have to talk about Edmund Friedman, don't we, Friedman? Oh my goodness. So I got a hefty dose of Friedman when I was a chaplain because the chaplain, head chaplain George Dobler and Ed were friends. They had studied together under Murray Bowen. So we just got so much Friedman from George, and in so many ways, I'm so grateful. The book we had to read as chaplains was Generation to Generation. I'm going to mention three Friedman books. We're going to be brief. This is my second recommendation. It's not my top one. I think my top one's going to surprise you. Generation to Generation was really Friedman's magnum opus. And at its heart, you can kind of tell by the title, he was looking at the patterns that go from family generation to generation, but he was doing it specifically through the lens of a congregation. So if you have any kind of faith congregation at all, Friedman was a Jewish rabbi, so he would look at the synagogue. But of course, in my faith, we look at the church. He was showing in this remarkable book how congregations act like families. Pastors kind of like dad, but there's also a black sheep and a secret keeper. And also when a pastor or a rabbi comes into a congregation, they are entering an existing system. Now, nowadays, I'm not sure that this is so revolutionary, but boy, when it came out in the, I want to say early 80s, this was pretty revolutionary. The idea that you could interview a congregation to understand the family dynamics and the generational patterns and the kinds of resistances you would be up against and how triangulation works and how you could differentiate and so on. Generation to Generation, I think it's Friedman's second best book. His third best book, ready for it? Failure of Nerve. Oh my goodness, come on people. Everywhere I go, people say they discovered systems theory through Failure of Nerve. I should be grateful because a lot of people have found my work through Failure of Nerve. This was Friedman's most famous book and his last book. It's his leadership book, and there are some absolute gems in there. I mean, who but Friedman could study world exploration and history, come up with the understanding that people were stuck for 1,000 years until Portugal started sending out explorers, Chris Columbus and people like that, and suddenly they went from societal regression to a breakthrough. He uses the idea of people exploring the new world as imaginative gridlock, which is one of the theories in Failure of Nerve. Okay, great book, really provocative, some fascinating stuff, but hard to read. I've had a lot of my students really balk at Failure of Nerve. They've struggled to get into it. They complain that it's very academic. Yeah, Friedman is worth reading because he's such a genius. He's so provocative. He loves to stir the pot. I'm putting Failure of Nerve as a great book, but it's my third favorite of Friedman's. What's my first favorite? Hey, long-term podcast listeners, you know it's Friedman's Fables. And hey, if you're new to the show, you can go back through the archives. I've read some of Friedman's Fables on the air on this podcast, just to give you a taste of them. This is Friedman at his best. He's a rabbi. He's provocative. He's creative. He's writing these parables, these fictions, these fables. And they're so playful and fun, but they also really stab you in the heart and they indirectly teach you systems theory. I'll give you an example. He has a imaginative chapter where Cinderella's stepmother gives the keynote address to the annual convention of marriage and family therapists. She's giving her side of the story. You got to read it for yourself. It's great. All right. Friedman. I mean, you know, there's so much that he teaches, but of course he's probably most famous for differentiation of self. This is one of the 8 core concepts of Bowen theory, differentiation of self. Now, some people read Friedman and they love the way he talks about differentiation. I got to confess, I struggle with it a bit because I think, in my opinion, he's sliding on the scale toward detachment a bit further away from connection. So, you know, I'm prone to enmeshment. So if you think of differentiation as a scale, some of us tend to get enmeshed. We get all wrapped up in other people. Some of us tend to get detached. We move away from others because we don't want to get involved in the mess. Differentiation, among other things, is the capacity to connect, emotionally connect to the other, but also be very connected to yourself, your vision and values, your reasons for doing what you do. And, you know, maybe it's because I'm prone to enmeshment that I struggle a bit with Friedman. His differentiation just feels a little cold. It also might be because I'm married to an attachment theorist, Lisa, who does therapy. She works a lot on attachment. And when we were, this is maybe 8-9 years ago now, when we were first really talking about differentiation, because, you know, we're nerds in our marriage, I guess, she was, I think, rightly saying, it doesn't feel like attachment. It feels like detachment. And also, when I open up the Gospels, you know, systems theorists say that Jesus of Nazareth is the most differentiated human ever to live, the best example of differentiation. I see Jesus working on attachment. I mean, even calling the Pharisees whitewashed tombs, even standing as the rich young ruler walked away, I think as a general posture, Jesus was always inviting people toward himself. That's attachment. So that would be my beef with Friedman. Okay. We could keep naming men, but here's one of the problems with systems theory. I'm going to get to this at the very end. So I'll just introduce this idea now. Fundamentally, it started out as white, Western, male, individualistic. And in many ways, it is still fundamentally white, Western, individualistic. But we do have some women who have written some great works. Let me give us two. Dr. Roberta Gilbert, she's a medical doctor. She has two books that people have found so helpful. Number one, The Eight Concepts of Bowen Theory. Bowen launched eight different ideas for us to wrestle with. The reason that birth order matters, the reason that our grandparents' habits and proclivities affect us, the power of triangulation to generate anxiety, so on. Eight concepts. Okay, I'll keep going, I guess. The way an entire society catches anxiety from each other and regresses into more and more anxiety, also known as Twitter. So Dr. Gilbert, Roberta Gilbert, she just wrote this very clear book, The Eight Concepts of Bowen Theory. Very helpful book. I personally find it a little dry, lacks the playfulness that I like, but it's a great book. Her second book, The Cornerstone Concept. Cornerstone Concept, an entire book on differentiation. Good book. Okay, but if we're talking women writers who really celebrate Bowen, we've got to talk about Kathleen Smith. Just wrote her first book, I think a year or two ago. I'm really excited. Kathleen's joining me on the podcast in just a few weeks, actually. We'll be interviewing her. And her book is called Everything Isn't Terrible. Everything Isn't Terrible. Oh, my goodness. Guys, great book. Kathleen Smith is a marriage and family therapist in Washington, D.C. She kind of coins herself as the calmest therapist in the most anxious city in the world. And this book is so great. Hey, if you are single and trying to navigate the dating scene, which is just such a challenge, Everything Isn't Terrible is the best book I've ever read to help you navigate dating. But kind of like Napier and Whittaker did, but with so much playfulness and joy, Kathleen puts us in the therapy room with her and her clients. And she's so practical. So she's fun, provocative, but extremely practical. In fact, if nothing else, I've never seen a better email newsletter on systems theory than Kathleen Smith's. Every time she sends me a newsletter, I'm like, this was so helpful, so good. Hey, so tune in a couple of weeks. She'll be joining me on the show. The book is Everything Isn't Terrible. I will say, because obviously I'm giving a lot of books in this 40 minutes or so, this would be my number one choice right now. If you could only read, you know how it is. If you could only read one book, what would it be? Everything Isn't Terrible, Kathleen Smith. So good. Okay, so far we have just talked about systems theory books. Great. What about books that incorporate faith, particularly because this is a Christian podcast? I mean, the podcast itself was not baptized as I think about it, but I'm a pastor, so my interest is Jesus of Nazareth. What about books that add faith? This is what got me so hooked on systems theory. Because reactivity is based on a false need, when we are in the grip of it, it then puts us in a false reality. And it's really hard to connect to God when we're living in a false reality. God exists in truth and concrete reality. I believe when Jesus said, you can know truth and truth can set you free, I don't believe he was just talking about eternal life. I think he was talking about a way of life. That every day we can ask God to show us the false things that we are giving ourselves to or the false things that have us in its grip. We can die to them and live in Jesus' truth. So systems theory that come from a point of view of faith or integrate faith, they are rare and amazing. And if we're going in historical order, we got to start with Pete Scazzaro. Pete's also been on my show. A couple of years ago now, you can go back and listen to my interview with Pete. That was like a bucket list for me. I was, it must have been 2004 or 2005. I'm trying to remember when I heard it. Podcasts were pretty new. And Mars Hill Bible Church in Michigan, when Rob Bell was the preacher, they would podcast their sermons and I would listen. I used to love listening to Rob Bell back in those days. Haven't listened to Rob in a while, but years ago, just loved his sermons. And one week there's a guest preacher, and it's some guy I'd never heard of called Pete Scazzero, and he described himself as the slowest moving pastor in the fastest city in the world. Pete was the pastor at New Life Church in Queens, New York City. This wonderful, fast-talking Italian with all this energy. And I'm listening to Pete preach this sermon, and I'm like, that's systems theory. He's preaching systems theory. This was the first time since chaplaincy, so probably like not quite 10 years, maybe 8 years after I'd been a chaplain, that I heard somebody share systems from the pulpit. And it really lit me up. I was so excited that there was a guy there. Okay, Pete's got a number of books, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality or Emotionally Healthy Leadership. You can't go wrong. If the name is Scazzero, it's going to be amazing. His wife, Jerry Scazzero, equally powerful systems theorist. Pete did his doctorate in genograms, family of origin work. And so his work on genograms is really good. And Jerry famously quit her husband's church. She had had enough of his anxiety, and she just quit attending when he was the lead pastor. A lot of pastors' wives love that story. So Pete and Jerry Scazzero, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. Well, Pete stepped away from the lead role and started doing that work full time and entered this young lead pastor named Rich Velotis. I think this week, Rich just celebrated 10 years as a lead pastor at New Life. Now, Rich took systems theory and he really moved it to a powerful, integrated, holistic discipleship. His book, The Deeply Formed Life. Deeply Formed Life, Rich Velotis. Hey, if Kathleen Smith's Everything Isn't Terrible is the one systems book I'd recommend, Rich Velotis' Deeply Formed Life is the one discipleship systems book I'd recommend. Now, it's not overtly systems, it's kind of, I don't know what you call it, like systems adjacent, systems informed. Rich teaches differentiation and stuff, but really it's just an amazing book on how do we grow in Christ? How do we enjoy the God we love? What kinds of things block that? Man, what a book. Rich has been on my show a couple of times, and I'm proud to be able to call him a friend. I've gotten to do some work with him and some of his discipleship out in Queens. I'll actually be out there in less than a month. I can't wait to see Rich and Andres and the team at the amazing work they're doing at New Life in Queens. Plus, Queens, what a place. All right, we're still in the realm of faith books. Jim Harrington, Trisha Taylor, Robert Creech. Their book is The Leader's Journey. Oh my goodness, guys. Jim Harrington, Trisha Taylor, Robert Creech. Robert Creech was a professor at Truett Seminary at Baylor in Texas for years. Jim Harrington and Trisha Taylor had been coaching and consulting churches and individuals and faith leaders for years now. Their book, The Leader's Journey, is so good. But I also just have to give a shout out for those of you who are not readers. Jim and Trisha have a podcast called The Leader's Journey. It's a must listen. It's so good. And so if you want to dive into some concrete systems, just talk to Jim and Trisha. And you're probably starting to see a pattern here. Yep, Jim's been on the show. Yep, Trisha's been on the show. Robert Creech has been on the show. You know, those of you who know me, I just find people I've learned from and I hunt them down like a dog. And most of them say yes, they'll love to come on the show. I am still hoping, I'll just put this out, folks. I am still hoping to find Ed Friedman's daughter. She helped him write Failure of Nerve because he died in the writing of that and she finished it. And I would love to get her on the show. If anyone has a connection to Ed Friedman's daughter, please do reach out. But Jim Harrington, Trisha Taylor, Robert Creech, The Leader's Journey, another great book that incorporates faith. Now look, there's some absolute legends that I'm neglecting. Peter Steinke, for example, is a legend with faith and systems theory. Jack Shitama, who is also on my show. But let's move on for the sake of time. Okay, just in my own narrative, okay, so I'm a chaplain. I'm trying to manage my anxiety. I'm discovering all my fears and all this stuff going under the surface, right? Death and trauma has a way of doing that. And then the head chaplain, George, is introducing us to Friedman and Bowen, and we're doing genograms and we're doing verbatims every week. We're doing all this work. And then I leave chaplaincy and I went to graduate school and I got a Master of Divinity at this amazing, really small theological school called Emmanuel. And the year I came in, they had a brand new counseling professor named Jack Holland. Jack was young and really just this warm guy. And I discovered early on that he was a systems guy. And so, you know, I'm young, I'm in my early 20s, and I'm nerding out with Dr. Holland about systems. And he basically invited me and the rest of us to discover the breadth of systems that was much wider than Bowen theory. And that's where I want to take the rest of our episode. Because I think part of the problem with when somebody founds a theory is we are too loyal to them, and we don't explore the other iterations of the theory. And so now that I'm traveling in the public sphere and I keep running into various systems theorists, like a lot of the authors I've mentioned I now know personally, which is an incredible treat for me. But I asked them about this other stream, the Bateson stream, not the Bowen stream, but the Bateson stream, second order change theory, the Mental Research Institute, the miracle question. We'll get into all of that in the rest of the episode here. And they've never heard of it. Like, I won't name names, but most of the systems people that I talk to, they've not heard of this stream. But so guys, there's a whole other parallel stream of systems theory, and it's amazing. And if I may, I incorporate it in my book as well. And yes, fantastic news, it will also be in my next book. When I release the next book in May, I believe we have a release date now, May 28th is still a ways away, I'll be incorporating Bowen and the Bateson stream. So you may never have heard of Gregory Bateson. He was married to Margaret Mead. She's quite a famous American philosopher. You may have heard of a guy named Jay Haley. He was one of Bateson's more famous students. This was more West Coast. Bowen was East Coast, Washington, D.C., Maryland area. Bateson, Haley, West Coast, Palo Alto, California. The Mental Research Institute, Brief Therapy. What they did is they wanted to study how things change. So they spent years trying to figure out how do problems form. And then having formed, how do we get perpetually stuck in our problems? And then where things got really fascinating is when they started to pay attention to our attempted solutions to these problems that were in fact keeping the problem going. So Jay Haley, one of the early adopters of this work, famously said when people would come in for therapy and they would say, here's my problem, he would say, I don't treat problems, I treat attempted solutions. Now, even that shift, it does something, doesn't it? As you're listening to that right now, just the idea of rather than focusing on the problem, what if you focused on your attempted solution to the problem? What are you doing that's keeping it stuck? Remember at the beginning of the episode when I said, systems theory forces us to look at our own complicity before noticing others. This is where attempted solutions come in. So here's a book. The book is called Change. That's the name of the book, Change. Subtitle is a little wonky. Principles of Problem Formation and Problem Resolution. So here's the whole title, Change, Principles of Problem Formation and Problem Resolution. Yeah, it's a mouthful, but hey, it gets worse because the author's names are also a mouthful. Watzlawick, Weakland, and Fish. Fish with a C, F-I-S-C-H. So if you're going to Google it, easiest to Google Change and Weakland. W-E-A-K-L-A-N-D. When I was getting my MDiv, I took every counseling class I could from Dr. Holland, and one of the first books he made us read was Change. Tough book. Kind of like Failure of Nerve is a tough book. It's a little academic, but man, it's fascinating because these therapists chased change theory wherever they could find it. So they went into thermonuclear dynamics and physics, or anywhere something changes, they wanted to study, how did something become a problem and then how does that problem dissolve? And that's where they came up with this incredible thing called second order change. This is one of the tools we teach in Capable Life, second order change. If you come and do an intensive at my house, we dig into second order change. We help faith leaders notice when they're stuck in a problem. Now, how do you know you're stuck in a problem? What's the difference between a problem and a stuck problem? It's usually the attempt at solutions. Most of us have problems and we're actually able to resolve many of our problems. That's just old-fashioned leadership and living. But stuck problems, they have two traits. Number one, they are recurring and predictable. Recurring and predictable. And number two, we fall into more of the same and try harder. Now, that's all I'm going to say about it, because next week Jimmy and I are spending a whole episode on stuck problems, recurring predictable patterns. So you'll have to wait for that, for us to dig into them. But this is the gift of Bateson, the Mental Research Institute, brief therapy, and so on. So book number one in this world is the book called Change by Watzlawick, Weakland, and Fish. That's kind of the academic book. They released that. It was pretty groundbreaking, and it came with a lot of criticism. A lot of therapists said, okay, this is all well and good, but this second order change, this attempted solution thing, it won't work with life and death counseling situations. So these guys are very provocative. They like to stir the pot. So their next book was called Brief Therapy with Intimidating Cases. And this is the book where they took the 8 most life and death cases they dealt with, the worst conditions people were in, and showed how this theory helps. Now, Brief Therapy with Intimidating Cases, I think that book came out, you know what, I don't know when it came out. It was 80s, it might have been early 90s. I want to say it was in the 1980s. I think a reasonable critique of this approach, especially for a Christian, it doesn't get to the heart. The Bateson guys, Watzlawick, Weakland, Fish, they don't care about heart motivation. They only care about measurable behavior. So the way they measure change is if your behavior changes. That's helpful. That's helpful. If you are coming into them and you're fighting uncontrollably in your marriage and they're able to stop your fighting uncontrollably, that's helpful. But I think we would agree that Jesus of Nazareth has a lot to say about heart change. And if I may, as a pastor, my personal take is the miracle of salvation isn't that I stop sinning. My behavior sometimes doesn't change as much as I want it to, you know, like Romans chapter 7. I think the miracle of salvation is Jesus changes what my heart wants. So Brief Therapy, the Mental Research Institute approach, it never touches the heart. That's a good critique of it. Okay, the final people I'm going to mention, Steve DeShazza and Insoo Kim Berg. Steve DeShazza, Insoo Kim Berg. They were, I believe they were trained by the Bateson crew, and then they end up in Michigan. So they're kind of known as the Michigan group. I know I'm nerding out a little bit here on systems, but hey, why not? And they introduced and really, you know what? Let me correct that. I'm not sure they introduced it, but they really focused on the power of what is called the miracle question. The miracle question, that's the book of theirs. And again, you may not need the book. There's plenty of articles written about the miracle question by Steve DeShazza and Insoo Kim Berg. You can just Google them and you'll find it. But I found this to be so helpful when I'm coaching people, whether I'm doing organizational consulting or whether I'm helping someone one-on-one. Because here's the deal. As a general rule, anxiety keeps things vague. And the miracle question, I'll get to what it is here in a bit, but the miracle question forces things to be really concrete and measurable and specific. And by doing that, it helps us have a target. So, you know, if we're feeling overwhelmed by a situation and we come in for help, we want to be well, right? You know, when Jesus said, do you want to be well? We say, yes, yes, I want to be well. But what if we don't know what well looks like, right? Like well can kind of feel like, I don't know, how would you say it? Like a vague target. How do I know what well looks like? How can we tell if we're making progress? Enter the miracle question. Here's what it is. let's say you come in for counseling and you come in to see a capable life coach. You've got all these problems. The counselor or the coach will say to you, okay, let's say you go to bed tonight, and as you're asleep, an angel comes in and waves a magic wand, and the overwhelming problem you brought into me is now taken away. It's gone. When you wake up, how would you know it's gone? That's the beginning. Like, the miracle question has a number of levels, but the first idea is, okay, somebody takes this problem away. What does your life look like? So somebody might say something like, oh, well, I guess I wouldn't be ruminating in my brain all the time. I wouldn't be always on the treadmill of worry. I guess I would feel my heart rate relax. Like, they start to say the target of what it looks like when you're now managing the problem rather than being managed by it. Sometimes the miracle question will say, how would your friends notice that your life is better? Oh, my friends would notice that I'm not always dumping on them. What it does is it forces you to imagine a future with concrete evidence that you're well, which then gives you a target to know. Because oftentimes when people are so overwhelmed by their anxiety, they don't even know when they're making progress. They're so overwhelmed, maybe they've made progress, but they don't give themselves credit for it because the anxiety is crushing. And so oftentimes then, once you've established the miracle question, you might then ask, well, what might be a little sign of progress toward that miracle? Like, look, we're not going to have a miracle, you know, in a week, obviously, but what would be a little sign of progress? And then the client might say, well, I guess I would have maybe an hour where I'm not worried about it. Okay, why don't we try that this week? And you can see where that's going. What the miracle question is doing is it's taking the abstract, making it concrete. Okay, that was a ton of books and resources. I hope that was helpful. Here's my final word on it. At the end of the day, this theory was born really in the early 1960s, white, Western, individualistic. And the fact is, here in 2023, it is still predominantly white, Western, and individualistic. And I really run into the limits of it when I travel, for example, to Southeast Asia, or I've done some of this work like in Paraguay, I've done some of this work in Nairobi, Kenya. These non-white, non-Western, non-individualistic cultures. And I find again and again that when people from those cultures are in a locked room with me and they feel safe to be themselves and to share their pressures they're carrying, they're very honest, they're very vulnerable, and my tools are very helpful in the moment. But then when our workshop is done, they're a bit lost as to, well, how do I leave this room with you and how do I apply this with my dad or with my Asian congregation, like, right? You get what I'm getting at here. And I just want to name that I'm aware that this is the limit of it. In some ways, it is a theory of privilege. Now, there are some people who are doing work or have done work. A gentleman named Brian Virtue did his doctorate after spending over 2 decades, I want to say 27 years in Manila. Now, Brian is white and Western, but he has put a quarter century in an Asian context, looking at how to apply systems theory in a communal, non-Western culture. My friend Marvin Williams, who's a phenomenal pastor up in Michigan, is doing his doctorate, and his doctoral dissertation is called My Whole Black Self. And Marvin is bringing differentiation into a racial conversation. Very helpful. So I'm really excited and I'm committed to amplifying non-white voices and non-individualistic culture voices. So if you know people who are doing this work in a non-Western, non-white, non-individualistic culture, I would love to hear from you because I would love to have some of those people on the show to talk about this because I do know it's a helpful theory. We just have to figure out the application once you've first learned it. And of course, that's the challenge. All right, folks. Hey, great to join you today. Really enjoyed chatting. I hope this was helpful to you. Look forward to seeing you next week. Or in fact, actually talking to you audibly next week. All right, that's it from me.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.